Ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies, thank you for being here. Good to have you with us again. I hope you're having a good day wherever you are. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Eyes Radio. The website is redeyes.tv. And, of course, we are gearing up for our next live show on Saturday the 11th at 5 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Central European Time. Exclusive at redeyesmembers.com. So if you're not yet a member, go there to sign up and watch it live or later as we archive it on the members' website. We are speaking with Andrew Fraser, author of The Wasp Question, today. The book deals with the question of Anglo-Saxon life in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and of course in Britain, everywhere across the world where they have settled, having for the most part lost sense of their own ethnic identity in a time of increasing globalism and international multiculturalism, which values nearly every other culture except their own. The WASPs, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, are alternatively mocked, attacked, and ignored in their own lands. Professor Fraser addresses the many questions involved in the matter, including constitutional and legal history, evolutionary biology, and Christian theology come all into play as well. Andrew Fraser is an associate professor in law at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. He has been teaching history and philosophy of law, public law, American constitutional history, modern corporate governance, immigration, and race relations. Stay tuned for more on the WASP question. Welcome, Drew. Thank you so much for being here. It's great to have you with us today. I hope you're having a good day down in Oz. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this. I've been familiar with some of your work for some time now. Of course, the WASP question is the book that really stands out to me. I know you have, of course, a new upcoming one that I do want to spend some time talking a bit about later as well. But one thing I'd want to address before we go into the meat of the WASP question is really, I guess, about your academic background. You taught legal history and constitutional law at Macquarie University in Sydney in Australia until you were suspended in 2005. Tell us a bit about this first.
Well, I wrote a letter to one of those throwaway suburban newspapers after seeing a story which featured a picture of a 3 or 4 year old Negro girl with a headline, who I guess had been born in Australia, and the headline was, "Now my mom and dad are Aussies just like me." And that really sent me right over the edge. So I wrote a letter essentially saying that, look, if you really want crime and violence and a whole plethora of associated social problems, just keep bringing in more sub-Saharan Africans. And I'm afraid it didn't go down well with the university administration when they became aware of it.
I bet not. And were you aware of that, or did you expect no one to read it maybe?
Well, that's right. It was just a local paper. I didn't expect them even to publish it, actually, but they gave it the first page. I mean, it's for them, I suppose it's a man bites dog sort of story, you know, academic actually criticizing immigration. Who's heard of such a thing?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, my colleagues at the university were absolutely apoplectic. They immediately organized an anti-racist forum, which I attended, and I was allowed to speak for at least 90 seconds.
Generous.
That's right.
So where did these shocking, horrible racist opinions come from then? Explain that to us.
Well, I mean, I grew up in small town Ontario, okay, which was a very homogeneous place, you know, by and large, totally dominated by Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And I was always a bit uneasy. Even when I would go down to Toronto as a kid, I'd have to say, I mean, and the other members of my family were similarly minded. We were just agitated by even the large number of Italians who were appearing in Toronto in the 1950s. So I've never been a big fan of diversity. I'd have to say. Although my opposition to it was sort of more subliminal than articulated, because, of course, in a university, I was an academic Marxist and so on. So it took me a while, really, to articulate that. And partly as a result of my experience here in Australia, where, and I suppose backing up one step, I came to Australia, among other reasons, because the whole French-English thing in Canada really bored me stiff, and I really wanted to get away from that. And when I first came to Australia in 1975, it was wonderful. You know, it was a completely white Australia. It was just the end of the white Australia policy. It was just being abolished then. And I loved it. And when, over the course of the next 40 years, Sydney turned into this alien space, I really did become much more vocal in my opposition to all this. And when One Nation appeared in the 1990s, I was a big fan of that movement. And again, which outraged most of my colleagues. But so
right.
That's just went from their point of view, I just went downhill from there.
Right. But it took you a while to kind of get out from the classic lefty academic rut then? It was something that kind of slowly just transformed you, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. You know, reality started to bite, I suppose.
But almost as the university was concerned, this kind of came out of the blue, right, for them?
Well, not really. In fact, I'd had several run-ins with the vice chancellor over related issues and so on. Or at least in part related to feminism. In fact, I mean, we had a female vice chancellor who expelled 9 men from the law school into our own little ghetto in the humanities department. And that way included, you know, a number of left-wing males. I mean, so I've been steaming for years over the feminization of the university. So there were a whole host of issues that put me on the outer with the administration.
So, yeah, definitely. I mean, I want to speak in greater detail today about what is happening in the Anglo-Saxon world. Yeah. And definitely let's talk about Australia a bit later. I know you've seen a change, obviously, over the years as, so many countries in the West, obviously. But let's back up a bit first and tell us, I would assume that the university experience is something that spawned you to write the WASP question, the book, or how did that come together?
Yeah, well, I certainly was, not so much surprised, but intensely disappointed that the people who seemed to be most offended by my attitudes towards women and diversity generally were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And so I really just began, after I was suspended, I spent 6 years trying to work out just what it is about WASP that makes it impossible for them to take their own side in a fight.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why in the subtitle of the WASP question, I refer to WASPs as the invisible race, because they really are invisible, especially to themselves.
Right. They were so extremely dominating for a while. And then now, eventually, if we fast forward to today, they're practically, as you say, they are indeed invisible. Now, let's back up and try to crack this nut from the beginning, so to speak, and tell us more about where you begin the story to understand what has happened. But I guess we can begin to explain the success a bit of the Anglo-Saxons. I would assume that you begin talking about when they first migrated from Southern Denmark, Northern Germany, over to the British Isles in what, the anywhere between 500-600, something like that, the migration age.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. And I was very struck when I was doing research on that period by a book written by a woman called Bertha Surtees Philpott back in the early 20th century. And she made an argument to the effect that kinship became much less important to the Anglo-Saxons in England than it had been back in Germany, simply because they were mainly men who left, and their relationship to their warlord, if you like, was essentially a covenantal sort of relationship. And so it's one of the germs of what is most striking about the Anglo-Saxon character, and that is its covenantal character. I mean, offshoots of that is the fact that the law of contract was essentially developed in England, and it became possible because English people were very much accustomed to having trusting relationships with strangers, and that made economic growth and development kind of much easier, and it worked a treat so long as English people were, in a sense, left in their own little bubble. But once we've, been introduced to people from other cultures and other races, we've tended to assume that we can trust them the way we trust each other, and I think that that's turned out to be a big mistake. Just one of the things that's characteristic of English culture is the importance of the common law tradition. So it's a very legal kind of culture, and we're very accustomed to dealing with each other in legal or even legalistic ways because we feel we can trust each other.
Well, people of Germanic stock certainly have been behind a lot of things, in inventions and everything else. But why is it, do you think, that it's when the Angles and the Saxons leave their homeland and go to England that a lot of things seem to go in a different direction? Why does that occur? Why do they become different, if you will?
Well, I think it was that covenantal sort of thing. According to Philpott, I mean, one of the consequences of that, as between Germany, let's say, and England. In Germany, kinship remained much more important, and you never really developed the lordship principle in the way that the English did. Lords and their underlings, if you like, did develop covenantal relationships, I suppose, which made it easier to develop into, a polity, a unified national polity in a way that never really happened in Germany until well into the 19th century. So,
do you think that the lordship principle was a function that they had to enforce in order to kind of maintain the society in a cohesive way? Because when people leave in this way, when they get uprooted, deracinated, they do lose sense, obviously, of their past to a certain extent. So maybe a legal structure arose because they had lost, to a certain extent, some parts of their heritage, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, there's a historian who argues that during the medieval period, you had a principle that he calls double majesty operating, where the aristocracy had a kind of a majestic aura surrounding it that paralleled the majesty invested in the kingship principle. And so there was always this sort of oscillation between the authority vested in the aristocracy and the authority vested in the king, which later, when you get down to the 16th and 17th century, becomes a contest between the king and the law, which
ultimately led to the Civil War in the 17th century, in fact, you know.
Yeah.
Because I read that principle, that conflict really couldn't be resolved apart from Civil War.
Interesting. What was it then about these people that managed to, I mean, they're still alive today, of course, but, you know, the organizational skill, the all these things that they develop, a legal system, an ability to survey almost in a similar way that the Romans did at their height. What else made them different?
Well, I suppose the feudal system developed in conjunction with Christianity and the church and so on. You get it. So, like, one of the striking things about Europeans generally, or Northwestern Europeans generally, and the English in particular, is the way in which society developed a kind of a Trinitarian sort of structure, you know, that matches, in a sense, the Trinity of the Godhead. And a lot, you know, you had those who prayed, those who fought, and those who worked. And even in the 9th century, Alfred the Great was remarking upon how his authority rested upon that sort of trifunctional social order. And it really developed a kind of a harmony between those three elements of the social order that really only began to break down in the 17th century with the rise of the Puritans and so on.
Right, exactly. Yeah. There's so many that have attempted to conquer and subjugate England. Part of me has always been curious why. You know, you had, invasion of the Danes later, the Normans through the Viking bloodlines in France.
Yeah.
Then you had William of Orange later, many of these people in many regards, more or less of the same stock as well, that has poured into England. Yeah. Was that anything that stood out to you in your research? Why was this such an important island?
Why was it an important island? Well, I mean, I suppose the distance of the relative isolation from the continent made it possible when the Danes and then the Normans come in for them to be absorbed into the people who were already there, the old English people. They had developed a kind of a national identity even before the Norman invasion, and indeed during the Viking invasions. Alfred the Great, in effect, seems to have been the person, the ruler, who actually, in effect, played the decisive role in the creation of an old English people with a consciousness of their own distinct identity and so on.
Right, exactly. I mean, when the Angles and the Saxons came over, they did bring some of their pagan ways. There was old runic monuments in England and stuff like that still. Yeah. But really, to a certain extent, maybe the Christianization of the Angles and the Saxons was what contributed to them transforming the way they did. I don't know if you see that as a good or a bad thing, but it's clear that gave them a different tone, shall we say, than the rest of the Germanic people that was still on the continent, right?
Yeah. Although, I mean, I do think you can kind of overemphasize the gulf between, let's say, the Nordic pagans and the Christians. I mean, when you, I don't know whether you're familiar with that stuff by Georges Dumézil on the tripartite nature of Indo-European religions.
Right. Yeah.
But I think there was a kind of a natural fit between Christianity and that Indo-European tradition. It's one of the reasons why, I mean, the doctrine of the Trinity emerges in the 3rd and 4th century in Cappadocia in what is now modern-day Turkey, but which I didn't realize this until recently, but did you know that Cappadocia in Turkey was actually settled by the Celts.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
And so that I'm sure that they, you know, their tri-functional social order and their tripartite Trinitarian religion really provided a kind of a seedbed for the transmission of Christian ideas into the European world, in a way similar to the way in which the Greco-Roman culture of the time also facilitated the transmission of those Christian ideas.
Hmm. So the Celts were all the way over there, huh? That's interesting. Now, speaking of the Celts, was there, I don't know if this is part of many of the things that you looked into, but didn't the Anglo-Saxons, were they, you know, particularly ruthless against the Celts when they came over, or did they kind of merge with them to a certain extent, that there was a blending maybe of these cultures that also contributed to this kind of advantage later, if you will?
Yeah, apparently there are genetic studies of the populations in the England, on the east coast of England and so on, that show that it was mainly sort of male male Anglo-Saxons who mixed with the local Celtic women. And so because there weren't too many Anglo-Saxon women, I guess, in the early days. And so, yes, they did seem to mix. And there weren't that many Anglo-Saxon invaders relative to the native population. So, yeah, once again, they seem to have formed a kind of hybrid culture in a way.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move forward a bit. And obviously, we, you know, people know WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Yeah. Tell us a bit when things start to formulate. You mentioned Alfred, of course, Alfred the Great as being very a huge part in kind of formulating this identity, if you will. What else are some of the big things that stand out historically that people should be aware of before we kind of talk more, go into the modern age of the WASP?
Well, I think the decisive moment was the 17th century with the Civil War and so on, because in effect, what happens with the rise of Puritanism, everyone ought to be enrolled as a warrior in the army of Christ. And so it just kind of flattens the world. And so it becomes the, what would you say, the thin edge of the wedge towards the creation of an essentially bourgeois society ruled by merchants. And that's what happens in modern England, isn't it? I mean, it's the commercial industrial core of European modernity and so on.
Yeah, so we're talking about law structure, mercantilism, all of these things are highly important to the Anglo-Saxons, right?
Yeah, yeah. And we lost something important, I think, when the aristocracy famously becomes very important in spearheading the development of England into a commercial and industrial power. They became merchants, in effect. So that now everybody is a worker, if you're a soldier, it's a career. If you're a minister in the church, it's a job, essentially. So it's not, you're not a member of a separate social order anymore.
So let's talk about when things go in a different direction here, because it felt always to me, anyway, from a distance, that it was kind of implied that many of the systems that was built, the English people, it was meant to be for them. But somehow along the road, this begins to change. Should we maybe talk about the American Revolution as being part of that, when things kind of no longer is implied to benefit their own people, but it's getting into this kind of cosmopolitan idea at some point, right?
Yeah. And again, the rule, of commerce. I mean, that's what America becomes, a commercial republic that really loses any sense of its Anglo-Saxon ethnicity as being part of its core identity, because of course you've rejected the throne, you've rejected the altar. Even though the Anglican Church sort of survives, it changes its name. You can't even call it Anglican anymore. Even before the Revolution, it was pretty much what would you say, a proto-bourgeois sort of society.
Yeah, the American Revolution goes hand in hand with the French Revolution. It brings this idea of libertarian ideas, basically, right? Somehow it's for everyone, and they have to separate themselves from the old ways and things like that. But at the same time, we have this happening in America. But despite the fact that America turned its back on England and the king and these kinds of things, the countries that were still part of the Commonwealth, or what today is the Commonwealth system, such as Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, they've gotten the same transformations that America has. How is that? How do we explain that?
I suppose within the 20th century, essentially the American Empire displaced the British Empire. I mean,
right.
if you want to give it a date, I mean, World War II. I mean, in 1942, essentially the American Army under General MacArthur takes over the defense of Australia. The British Empire is over. And by the 60s, Britain has joined the common market. It's Hollywood has taken over Australian culture, and of course in Canada, even more so. I mean, that was one of the things. When I was a kid in high school, I actually got thrown out of high school for briefly because maybe 1962, 63, because I refused to stand up for God Save the Queen in an assembly. And to I guess looking back on that, trying to work out what was going on in my mind, I think on some level, I was just kind of aware that Britain, the monarchy, all of that was losing its relevance to Canada. Because Britain was clearly no longer interested in maintaining that imperial or anything like an imperial relationship with Canada. And so the same thing was happening in Australia and New Zealand. People really felt a strong sense of abandonment, in effect, by Britain. The Americans essentially came in to fill that, what would you say, political vacuum.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know what, let me back up here a little bit too, because I just thought of something that I missed here, a big point in this. You know, many of the kind of patriots in America today, they obviously venerate the Constitution, but going further back than that, you have the Magna Carta, for example. These are unique ideas at the time, obviously. I think this has helped to lead a country like America into becoming like a shared identity of civic nationalism, as opposed to an ethnic based one, which is more tribal in the sense that the old European societies were. What can we say about that period and the Magna Carta and the Constitution and kind of what America has become today? It's a big, big question, big point, of course, but what should we know about how those things kind of have arisen?
Well, it relates to what we were talking about earlier. If you think about the development of England and later Great Britain,
Over time, I mean, the idea of the Constitution becomes very important to the British as well. And in effect, that's the law, the Constitution become the way in which the British people conceive their collective identity. A fortiori in America, the cult of the Constitution became the only source of collective identity for Americans, other than the fact, I guess, that they were white as compared to the black slaves and so on in the South.
Yeah.
The cult of the Constitution was important in Britain, but still, people thought of themselves as English, Irish, Scottish, or Welsh. In America, you know, even the Anglo-Saxons sort of really weren't able to retain that ethnic identification after the Revolution. And so they thought of themselves, I mean, let's put it this way. I mean, like, if you think about race, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, race has a kind of a biological element. It also has an ethnic element. And it also has a very important theological kind of element that, you know, like in Britain, for example, after the Civil War, Britain with an O, thought of themselves as a Protestant nation. And Anglicanism became an important element in the creation of that English identity in particular. But in the United States, the revolution was, in a sense, a kind of a war of religion, rejecting that Anglican identity in favor of, you know, one or other sort of dissenting creed. You know, you're a Methodist or a Presbyterian or whatever. And there was no common sort of theology of what it meant to be American, other than the cult of the Constitution, which is really, what is the theological element to Americans' national identity.
How much do you attribute that particular, you know, how that played out to the fact that there was a lot of Freemasons involved at the time in helping to shape the American Revolution, right? George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, all these people, they were kind of steeped in this idea of, you know, no religion. It's the great architect of the universe. You can believe in whatever God you want to believe in. It's kind of coupled with the French Revolution again. I'm back to that point again of these Jacobins and these people who were very much about, you know, liberty above everything else, right?
Yeah. That's true, you know, and the American Revolution, I think, really laid the basis for the French Revolution, and in many ways, it over the past 100 years, it's become a couple of 100 years, it's become apparent that the American Revolution was far more radical and revolutionary in its consequences than even the French Revolution, I think.
Yeah, look at it's taken a bit longer, I guess one can assume, but look at the influence of it, right, today.
Yeah.
All over the world.
I try to sort of lay that out in the WASP question, you know, by talking about the essentially the way in which there have been four republics, at least in the United States. You know, it's much like France. We're down to the fifth republic in France. We're into the fourth republic in the United States. And the first American republic was kind of a federal republic, which was based upon the idea of liberty you know, for independence from Britain, the liberty to do what you wanted with your own life, and so on and so forth. And then that was an extremely revolutionary idea that people then said, well, if this is a country based on liberty, how can we have slaves?
Right.
And so you get the whole abolitionist movement and the Civil War. And so you get the second American republic, what I call the second bourgeois republic, which is essentially based upon the idea of equality. Equality between black and white. Okay, it's just a formal legal equality, but nevertheless, and also equality between men and women.
Yeah.
You know, with the 19th Amendment, which gives women the vote. And then that's fine. But then the Great Depression comes along, and you get a third republic with the New Deal, a kind of managerial therapeutic republic where eventually you get the whole civil rights movement based upon the idea of fraternity, you know, that we ought not just to grant blacks, let's say, formal legal equality, but we should integrate them into the life of the American society generally. And now with Obama, we're down to the fourth transnational republic based upon what would you say, the basic principle, diversity?
Right, yep.
Yeah,
interesting. So this has been a struggle towards the kind of equality that we see today. So to a certain extent, whether intentional or not, the world that we live in today is really the legacy of the Anglo-Saxons, correct?
I think so, yes. Yes. You know, we live in the American Empire. The entire world does, except for, I suppose, Russia and China, you know.
And then, of course, the ironic thing here, Andrew, is that the race, the people, the tribes, if you will, that developed all of this is now the one tribe that cannot take its own side. It cannot even credit for inventing this idea of equality and liberty. It's the only group that everyone else now turns their back. Well, I mean, there's more than the Anglo-Saxons, of course. We can speak about Europeans and white people in general, but nonetheless, they kind of, when it comes to the American question, they always dub the white people in America as the WASP, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they are the people everybody loves to hate.
Yeah.
You know, I was very struck when I was thinking about the WASP question by the fact that the leaders of American white nationalism, even though some of them wouldn't describe themselves as white nationalists, but think of, you know, Jared Taylor, Peter Brimelow, Richard Spencer, Greg Johnson, they're all basically WASPs, but they really appeared, as far as I can tell, to refuse to identify themselves as such, and certainly do not seem to feel any strong bond with other WASPs. They prefer to think of themselves as sort of whites or pan-Europeans and so on, which I think is not just a pity, but a kind of an example of the sort of ethnopathology that seems to debilitate white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I mean, if you're an Italian American or an Irish American or a Swedish American, I mean, people are more eager to express solidarity with their co-ethnics, but WASPs are not like that, and I think that's a great weakness, because I mean, if you could get WASPs in, especially in the United States, to identify with the history and the culture of their own people, it seems to me that that would actually strengthen rather than weaken the sort of pan-European or white struggle to assert themselves.
Why is that, do you think? It just it becomes more clearer and defined, you mean, in terms of ancient of their heritage or something?
Well, I mean, I know that I've heard you say, for example, that you find it hard to identify yourself as a white because you think of yourself as a Swede.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't make it more difficult for you to identify with other Europeans of different ethnicities. And in fact, it probably makes it easier because you can see, you want to preserve your own ethnic identity. You want to preserve your own people, which makes it easier for you to empathize with the struggle of other European ethnicities to preserve themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't really have a strong sense of your own ethnic identity, as most WASPs clearly do not, it seems to me that the idea of white solidarity is just a bit intellectual and abstract, if you get my drift.
Yeah, I mean, it's I just, do. No, I do. Do you think, Drew, that since the WASP as a concept, whether people actually are, you know, Anglo-Saxon or Protestant or not, they have held a special place in Hollywood and the educational system and the media as someone to pin all the problems basically in the world on, right? So has that contributed to the fact that people maybe disassociate themselves from that identity if they do belong to it?
Sure. I mean, the word itself, WASP, I mean, it's really a snide little slur on Anglo-Saxons. I mean, it's not a compliment to call someone a WASP, is
no,
it?
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
I've seen it so many times in movies and in TV shows, and, you know, Hollywood is experts at attacking them, right?
Yeah. And it's sort of like, and I think really WASPs need to start to own the word in the way that Negroes own the word nigger.
Right.
You know? Yep. I mean, it's been used as a slur against us. We ought to just grab it and assert ourselves as such.
Yeah, that's true, because they're kind of developing a movement now, Drew, that's kind of, well, it's more in a humorous way, of course, but they've kind of adopted the slurs that our enemies make against us, specifically when it comes to things such as National Socialism and these kinds of things, right? They kind of take the idea and run with it, and it kind of makes it more fun, to be honest. Maybe that's a good idea in terms of the WASP.
Yeah.
All right, so let's see what else here we should touch upon. I mean, there's so many, you know, aspects, of course, to the book. Anglo-Saxon Identity in the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the New World Order, or the secular age that we are in right now. What else do you think we should say about the kind of world that's developed now? Let's talk a bit about this idea of diversity and these kinds of issues. I mean, obviously, the situation that we find ourselves in, whether it's America, whether it's, unfortunately now, largely any European country or where Europeans dwell, if any person, no matter what race, background, biology, what have you, if they hold a passport from X country, then they pretty much consider themselves to come from that country, right? That's really where things have developed. And on the other hand, if someone, if a white person who holds a Japanese airport passport claims that they are Japanese, people would, of course, laugh at them. There's actually examples of this, and people who have written articles about that very fact, and they are so, you know, upset over the fact that when they come to like certain Middle Eastern countries and African countries, they all laugh at this white person for having a Japanese passport. But how has this developed, this idea that, you know, a passport makes you now a citizen of every land? Everyone can become an American, right? This has really become the religion of our times almost, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in
it's especially interesting from the point of view of people from Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, I think, because in fact, up until 1948, there was no such thing as a Canadian citizen, an Australian citizen, or a New Zealand citizen. We were all British subjects. I was born a British subject. And Canadian citizenship came in 1948. And even then, it was kind of, what would you say, an abstraction, divorced from any clear ethnic identity, because, of course, you had English Canadians and you had French Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
And the French Canadians at that time were beginning to think of themselves as potentially a separate nation, and so on. So I guess the similar thing happens in the United States when, you know, after the emancipation of the slaves. I mean, prior to that, an American was at least, you knew they were white, effectively, but once citizenship becomes available to even emancipated ex-slaves, American citizenship starts to become very, very abstract. And then, of course, you've got that huge wave of immigration in the late 19th, early 20th century that created all manner of hyphenated Americans, you know, the Germans, Swedes, Jews, you name it. And so it's the, I suppose, in the American century then, it becomes very, very easy to think of citizenship as just a legal category that is divorced from any specific cultural or ethnic or racial identity. And of course, I mean, that was already true in Britain. I mean, British subject, well, that included English, Irish, Scottish, and Welsh, you know? So it was a kind of a civic nationalism as well, even then.
So this idea of ethnomasochism, what is it that makes Europeans so susceptible to this very detrimental practice?
That is a big question. I mean, where would you start? I suppose you'd start in the United States with slavery, that really ethnomasochism became a kind of an art form with, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, it was just the idea of white Southerners was something that, you know, was innately evil in the eyes of Yankeedom. And then, of course, you know, World War II, you know, National Socialism, you know, the Holocaust religion and so on. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, there's no end of explanations, is there?
No.
You know, South Africa, apartheid, what haven't we done?
Right.
To feel bad about ourselves, you know?
Yeah, and then we feel good about feeling bad about ourselves, like your Jared Taylor has said.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right, you know? It becomes a sign of virtue to denounce your own ancestors.
Truly remarkable. Talk to us a bit about the third part of the book, the prognosis, the return of the repressed. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, It does seem to me that Anglo-Saxons really do need to get a sense of themselves as outside England, in particular, as a diaspora community, on a par with the Jews or any other diaspora community. It seems to me that that's
something that is not only desirable, but it's also sort of possible, especially in, you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. I mean, we still do have institutions like the monarchy that do, at least implicitly, put a stamp of a common identity on Anglo-Saxons wherever they are in the world. And I think it's important that we try to nurture that sense of Anglo-Saxon identity. And this is one of the reasons why I think, you know, it's absolutely vital not just to find institutions outside the state that are capable of nurturing that. And I think in particular, probably foolishly, of the Anglican churches being one of those institutions that certainly ought to be trying to give its parishioners, if you like, some sense of their history and culture and so on. But of course, that is a big struggle in itself, because the Anglican Church now understands itself as a globalist institution. And that's why I think it's nevertheless important to struggle against that. But monarchy, church, are two of the institutions, I think, that they can begin to, I mean, at least it's at least a theoretical possibility. I'm not sure I'd really want to press it beyond that at this point. But it is possible for the monarchy and the Anglican Church to return to their roots as the vehicles for a collective ethno-culture and ethnic identity, and the church in particular. This is why I think the whole idea of ethno-theology is really crucial in the development of the Anglo-Saxon people. We really do need to get a sense of our ethnic identity as a way of, as a kind of a religious experience again.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point. And by the way, I just want to squeeze in here quickly that the, of course, you have an upcoming book here called Dissident Dispatches from Divinity School that I'd like to ask you a bit more about later. But, you know, one of the things that you end the book with is postmodern rebirth of Anglo-Saxon Christendom. Can you explain a bit more about this and also kind of tell us how you see the church in being well culprits in pushing the multicultural agenda, and also maybe if they've done some good things maybe in the past to resist that?
Okay. Well, essentially what I'm trying to argue is that again, to go back to my earlier point, you know, about the Trinitarian nature of race, if you like. I mean, you've got race as biology, race as ethnicity, and race as theology. And if you don't have all three of those elements involved in the construction of your collective ethnic or national identity, something is definitely missing, and something is going to go wrong with you as a people. And so essentially what I'm trying to do in the last part of that book is think about ways in which you could a Christian ethno-theology could become a crucial building block in the recovery of our sense of collective identity. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, sure. I see what you're saying.
And it's it it's uh, it, the problem is that as I was, and it's most acute, obviously, in the United States. If you don't have a Christian ethno-theology, you're going to have a theological dimension to your concept of collective identity, whether you know it or not. And in the United States, that's historically has been, that function has been served by the cult of the Constitution. But now, I mean, let's say on the alt-right, I mean, people have, by and large, no longer seem to identify with Christianity. They no longer even identify with the cult of the Constitution. And the question is, what sort of religious element is there in the kind of white identity that the alt-right wants to construct? I really think there's a big hole there. And that hole is especially large for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who can't even turn to the religious elements attached to, let's say, an Irish or an Italian or a German or a Swedish identity. Unless that theological issue is addressed, there are going to be all sorts of pathologies developing within Anglo-Saxon ethnic groups. You know, I mean, it's just which you can see. I mean, all around us. I mean, WASPs are really in a bad way.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And unfortunately, on the alt-right, there seems to be obviously a lot of focus and time and dedication spent to fights, you know, between pagans and Christians, and even atheists are in there in what direction and whatnot. Yeah. Although I would, you know, have things to input in that debate, I think at this point, it's a futile battle to try to rage that within the ranks and try to control others, what they should think or whatnot. It's almost like what I would advocate in terms of a religion and belief and faith. It's almost like that the tradition, the heritage, the ancestry, and the idea of European culture overall, that should be a kind of a faith to a certain extent, a spiritual belief in the fact that, you know, we need to preserve and protect and make sure that our way of life is something that that continues, you know, and that religion is something that is respected within that umbrella. That yes, Christianity is part of it, but so is our pre-Christian heritage and tradition, and it all should be accepted within it, as opposed to spending all this time and effort fighting with each other again, as we usually do. I think it's horrible to see that.
No, I totally agree, and that's why I was suggesting earlier that really the gulf between paganism and Christianity has been much overstated. I mean, I think it's really quite remarkable. I mean, if you look at the way England again, in the first millennium, the way with the Viking invasions. I mean, I think it's quite remarkable how easily the Danes, the Norsemen, and so on, managed to fuse themselves into a common English society. And which says to me that whatever, and it's hard to know what that pagan, you know, Scandinavian paganism was all about, but it must have had at some very basic level, it must have been easy for the Scandinavians to find and make common cause, religiously even, with the old English stock. I don't know whether you ever come across it, but I was reading earlier this year, an extremely interesting sort of ninth century book called Helion, the Saxon Gospels. Have you ever come across that?
No, I haven't. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, when Charlemagne conquered the Saxons, it was a pretty bloody affair.
Yes,
In an attempt to bridge the gulf in between the Franks and the Saxons, somebody, we don't really know who, but wrote a Saxon wrote in Old Saxon a version of the Gospels, which presented Jesus Christ as essentially a Germanic warrior.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and tried to get the successfully to get the Saxons, the defeated Saxons, to accept the faith and to recognize that their this new Christian faith was not in any way opposed to the kind of Germanic warrior culture that they were living in. So I just think it's another piece of evidence that Germanic paganism and Christianity were made for each other, I think.
It's interesting. Well, obviously there was some overlapping here in the myths. There was also some tweaking, I think, to kind of fit it into the times. Yeah. There's other authors and people that have said that Christianity, in the way that it has developed, has been uniquely designed for Europe. I don't know if I would agree with that or not, but in the East we had things such as the dual faith, for example, for a long time, and I think the same way in the Nordic countries, despite the fact that the incursion of Christianity was very violent. There was obviously a lot of people that were using runes and the old ways long after it was kind of Christianity was as the official state religion, if you will, of the country that later became Sweden. So it's interesting. It's an interesting point.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, what do you say, Andrew? Should we take maybe a short break here and then continue and talk a bit more in the second segment? Time has just flown by here, but obviously the book, ladies and gentlemen, that we're talking about is The Wasp Question. And then in the second segment, I want to speak more about the upcoming book, Dissident Dispatches from Divinity School. And I want to get into more detail about that. But Andrew, tell us first, of course, how people can get a copy of the WASP question. And if you have any websites of your own or anything like that you'd like to share with us here.
Okay, well, the WASP question is quite easy to acquire. I mean, from Amazon.com or directly from Arctos.com. And as for websites, I'm afraid I'm a technological primitive. I'm still very much in the print mode, and so I don't really have a website.
That's fine. Do you have any other, are you on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm an old fogey when it comes to things like that.
You got to get on Twitter, Andrew. That's where it's at these days. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, okay. Arctos.com. We'll have a link up to where you can buy a copy of the book. We also have Amazon.com there. And yeah, definitely check it out, ladies and gentlemen. Very interesting book. A lot of interesting things in it. And we'll talk more about that and, of course, the new upcoming book in the second segment. So, stay tuned, everyone. Stay tuned, Andrew. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with more.
It was not part of their blood. It came to them very late, with long arrears to make good. When the Saxon began to hate, they were not easily moved. They were icy, willing to wait. until every count should be proved, ere the Saxon began to hate.
Well, you can join us at redicemembers.com for the second hour as we proceed with Andrew Fraser and talk more about his latest project called Dissident Dispatches from Divinity School. We'll get into the question of Christianity's role in Anglo-Saxon culture and the larger European culture. There are many things here which I do not agree with when it comes to Andrew's analysis regarding the role of Christianity, but we'll listen to what his ideas are and what is going to be in the forthcoming book. By the way, before we proceed, we have Vox Day and Cynic in Chief up next to talk about the SJW list and the recent attack on the alt-right by these so-called conservatives from PJ Media, David French, and these other outlets. All right, stay tuned. Much more coming up with Andrew Fraser in the second hour. Join us at redicemembers.com.